Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is the AGLCA Weekly Radio Show. And as usual, we have me, Steve, hosting it. And then we have Beth and Janice from the Homeport crew. We think Roger got lost on his way to work. But he'll be with us eventually, I hope. And this week for a guest, we have Chuck Baer, who is the general manager of Waterway Guides. And for those of you don't know about Waterway Guides, they're probably the preeminent guide for boating any place, in at least in the East. I think they all, Chuck, you also do one in the West, don't you, for the West Coast?
No, we don't have anything on the West Coast of the U.S. yet, but we pretty much cover everything from the Mississippi River east and everything from the Bahamas north to the Canadian border.
Yeah, and I know Janice and I, whenever we're cruising, one of the first thing we do for planning is look at Waterway Guides. So, you know, if you're going to go cruising, go take a look at them. Chuck is going to talk today about the changes on the Intracoastal Waterway. And it's the Atlantic Intracoastal Waterway, which runs from Key West all the way to Norfolk, Virginia. So with that said, I'm just going to let him wait a minute. Janice says I got to plug call-ins. So if you all have any questions and want to talk to Chuck or ask him a question, you can call us toll-free at 877-497-1815. And feel free to call in. We'd love to hear from you. And Chuck, talk about the background of you and Susan and your history on the ICW.
Okay. Well, Susan and I have been boaters for decades, and every time I tell everybody how many decades, it scares me, so I won't tell you that. But we bought our first cruising boat almost 20 years ago now. And we took our first shakedown cruise on that boat from the Chesapeake Bay down to the Bahamas and then back to the Chesapeake Bay. So that was our first trip on the Intracoastal Waterway, the Atlantic Intracoastal Waterway. Since then, we have done, I believe, 8 round trips between New Jersey and the Florida Keys. And we've also done 2 trips on the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway. And we've been cruising for a long time, so we've covered the Northern Caribbean, including the U.S. and British Virgin Islands, Hispaniola. We've had the opportunity to cruise Cuba and done the Western Caribbean in Mexico, Belize, Guatemala, and Honduras.
Cool. Good.
Chuck, what kind of a boat do you have? Have you had the same boat the whole time?
Actually, we just switched gears here a little bit. We originally had a 40-foot sailboat that we did most of our cruising on. And 2 years ago, we sold the sailboat and bought a trawler. And the reason for that was that we decided we wanted to switch gears. If you can believe it, every beach started looking the same. It had the same palm trees on it. And we decided we wanted to do more inland waterways and specifically wanted to do the Great Loop. So the sailboat wasn't really ideal for that, so that's why we sold that 2 years ago and bought the trawler.
So as a long-term sailor, did you have friends that told you you went over to the dark side?
Oh, absolutely. We still hear it every day.
Stink putts. You know, I guess the next we want to talk a little bit about inside and outside options when you're going up along the ICW.
Yeah, exactly. And you do have 2 options. And one is, you know, to take the Intracoastal Waterway. Once you get down south of the Chesapeake, the Intracoastal starts at mile zero there in Norfolk. And we have, on more than one occasion, taken the ICW all the way inside down to the Florida Keys. And then there have been other times when we have gone both inside and outside. And a lot of that is really weather-dependent for going outside, especially now with the trawler as opposed to the sailboat. Sailboat was a little different then. But the inside passage, of course, is going to take longer, and most of the time, you know, the runs are limited to the number of hours of daylight because it's really not a good idea to try to run the ICW at night, where the outside passages you can do virtually 24-hour. We've done 2 or 3-day runs on some occasion both day and night. So you can make a lot more distance in a shorter period of time going on the outside, but you miss a lot in doing that. And then, of course, as I said, it's very weather dependent. You have to keep your eye on the available inlets when you're outside should the weather start to turn bad, where you'll be able to get back in rather quickly. And sometimes the inlets along the ICW can be quite far apart because although there are a lot of them that are usable, there are a lot of them that, unless you're very knowledgeable on the local conditions, shouldn't be used. And then there are others that virtually can't be used on those inlets.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a couple in the area where we live that are like that. You don't even want to try them most of the time.
That's right. And even some of the more usable inlets, there are issues from time to time. Masonboro and Riceville Beach is a good example, and right now we're having issues in St. Augustine, where that's normally a very usable inlet, but now there's some severe shoaling starting to encroach in the approach channel there, which is creating problems for folks.
Interesting. What do you prefer, inside or outside?
Well, actually, our preference is inside, because going inside, you know, you truly get to experience the intercoastal waterway, and that's what we're down there for, is the experience. And if you run outside, you miss all the little towns and some of the great anchorages along the way. And, you know, we think that's part of the whole experience. Even if our plans are to travel from the Chesapeake to Florida or the Bahamas, you know, visiting all of the towns and anchorages along the way is all part of that entire trip.
Yeah, I don't know, 2 years ago, Janice and I went down to Fort Lauderdale, and the one thing that we found, and if we do that trip again, we'll probably run at least a couple of days outside, but once we got south of, I can't remember the name of the town, as we got south, there were so many bridges, and of course, you can't get from one to the other before it opens, so I think we had days where we're averaging 3 knots trying to get there. And, you know, which is fine, but it was just very long days for not much mileage.
Yeah, and that's always an issue, and it's always a consideration. And that's why I say we generally do a combination of the two. And we know the areas, especially in Florida that you're talking about, where, you know, the number of bridges can mean the difference between traveling 30 miles in the course of a day and, you know, running offshore and traveling 60 or 70 miles in the course of the day. And then there are other areas that there are other navigational issues to be considered, and given the opportunity, rather than try to deal with all of those, we just would prefer to jump outside, jump back in, and bypass those areas.
And
I would think,
river. Go ahead.
I would think if, go ahead, never mind.
No, go ahead, Beth.
I was just going to say, I would think that if you're doing the loop, that the purpose of doing the loop for most people is to see things that you wouldn't normally see. So going outside kind of defeats that purpose. I mean, if you're not doing the loop, if you're just down there for a short trip or whatever, I could see wanting to make as many miles as you could. But it seems like the loop is all about just seeing the little anchorages along the way and things like that, so I would think most people would want to stay on the intercoastal. Not exactly.
And that's why the inside route is always our preference.
Yeah.
Chuck, you want to talk about the changes you've seen over the years?
Yes. We really got to contemplating this on our last trip, and it was, I believe, the early 90s when we made our first trip. And the fascinating part about that trip was that there were just miles and miles and miles of undeveloped areas where you felt like you were the sole person out there, and there were no houses. We saw very few other boats. It was pretty incredible. As a matter of fact, you know, so there were days when we thought, wow, what would happen if we broke down? There's nobody else out here but us. There are no facilities. Who would we call? What would we do? We were pretty self-sufficient. But, you know, it still was a little bit nerve-wracking under some of those conditions. And we noticed that on this last trip, it seems like that the ICW, except with a very few exceptions, has pretty much developed from Norfolk to Miami. There are very, very few areas where the shoreline isn't full of houses and condominiums and apartments and commercial buildings. So the development's been absolutely incredible, as it has been by pretty much anywhere on any waterfront. Some of the other things that we've noticed from that first trip, of course, since 2001 was the increased security presence, especially in large ports, particularly areas like Norfolk and Charleston and Miami, anywhere where the ships come in. We've seen a big increase in both local law enforcement and the Coast Guard and Homeland Security. We've been flagged down and questioned several times by Homeland Security in areas I would have never considered. And there are areas like in Norfolk now where it's virtually off limits. When you get near the naval yards and the Coast Guard is escorting ships in and out of the major ports and keeping pleasure boats away. So we've seen a lot of that along the way, which was a big change from the early years. The increased number of boats that are now making the migration north and south is just exploded. And we haven't noticed in the last couple of trips a trend where there are groups of boats that seem to be traveling together. And there'll be one boat in particular who's probably done the trip several times that will sort of be in charge and kind of remind us of the mother duck and the duckling that you see cruising around the river. And it's funny because you can hear them on the radio, of course, because they communicate on VHF. We call it reading their mail. And you can tell the leader will decide towards the end of the day where everybody's going to anchor or what marina they're going to stop at. And he'll get the group together in the evening and discuss the plans for the next day. And he's pretty much in charge and decides the venues and so forth for the others. And, of course, if anybody has any problems on the boat, you know, he's right there to troubleshoot. So, you know, I suppose it's kind of a good thing for new folks that have never done the trip before, and it kind of helps them along the way and makes them feel a little better.
Our discussion forum at AGLCA will often see someone saying, I'm leaving this area around this day. Would somebody like to travel with me? The loopers like to go as groups.
Well, some of them do.
Yeah, and others don't. But you know, it's just something that we had never noticed before in the past, and it seems to be more and more prevalent. And it's just kind of an interesting situation to watch. And every once in a while, we'd get to a bridge, and of course, the leader would handle all the communication with the bridge tender and tell them how many boats would come through. And every once in a while, we'd mix in with a group, and he'd make sure to tell them, well, that boat isn't with us. So, just funny. But, you know, in that same respect, I remember that when we were traveling down the waterway in the past, we would get into anchorages or specific towns, and you kind of knew who the other cruisers were. And there was a lot of camaraderie there, and the people would get mingle, and someone was always rowing over to our boat and introducing themselves and so forth. The downside I've seen with these smaller groups is that they tend to stay together in their little group. And when they get to the anchorages and they get to the marinas, they still seem to stay in their little group. And we don't see that openness and that camaraderie that we used to see early on in the waterway. And maybe it's just because these folks are new and, you know, this is their first or second time down. But it just seemed that was kind of missing.
What, you know, I've seen the what you're talking about with, I don't know, like Sea Ray at Charleston will decide that they're going to have a cruise and they'll have 20 boats go with them to wherever it is they're cruising to. And,
right.
That, you know, where at least Janice and I are more, we're going to go, we're going, and if we meet somebody there, that's fine, but we've got our own plan to take care of.
Right, and we actually had a fellow that was kind of traveling with us, and he called me on the radio today and said, are you leaving today? And then if we left, he would follow along, and he wanted to go somewhere one day, and he said, are you leaving today? And we said, no, we just don't like the weather. And he actually got upset with me because we had decided that we weren't leaving today, and if we didn't leave today, he didn't know what to do.
Well, okay. Anyway, It's my turn or time again to encourage people that are listening to call in and ask questions. So the toll-free number is 877-497-1815. We'd love to hear from you. So I guess the next little topic is shoaling and navigation hazards on the ICW.
Yes, and shoaling has really, really become a major problem over the last 10 years, and the problem is twofold. And of course, the biggest issue is funding for the dredging. You know, most governments now just don't have the money, and that has really taken a low priority since the commercial shipping along the ICW has dropped. The other problem is environmental issues, because we've talked to the Corps of Engineers, and where they have the ability and the funding for dredging, because of the regulations required to dispose of the dredged materials, they can't do it. So it's kind of a two-edged sword there. But there are areas now that have shoaled so badly at times they're just almost completely impassable. I mean, areas like Carolina Inlet, Lockwood Follies, and Fields Cut, any of us that have ever done the ICW a couple of times know that those are always issues.
Yep.
But the Little Mud River in Georgia has got to a point now where you can't do it with any kind of a draft unless it's high tide. The Tansas Inlet is another one, which is a constant problem. So the shoaling is an issue, and it changes from year to year. They are doing a lot of dredging this year, but unfortunately it's not in some of the serious areas. And then you've talked – go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know, I know there's an Atlantic Intercoastal Waterway Association that kind of helps, I'm going to use the word lobby, but make Congress aware of all of this.
Right.
My question is, has anybody ever proposed something like in the states that the ICW runs through, paying a couple of bucks a year for each boat that's registered and using that money to give the Corps the money they need to dredge it?
Well, actually, the state of Florida does that, and yes, I just attended the Intercoastal Waterway Association's last meeting down in Norfolk, and they have proposed that. The state of Florida does that. They have an inland waterway fund that pays for most of the dredging, so they don't have to wait for federal dollars. And it is important, and what we need to do is to get the boaters out there in their specific states and let their legislators know how important the waterway is, because unfortunately they just don't, in a lot of cases, they don't understand how important it is to the economy and to the state itself as far as tourism and a lot of other issues. It's just kind of taken a back burner, and they don't. If they're not out there, they don't see the waterway. They're just sitting in the state capitol looking at some of the bigger issues, and I think that's part of the problem.
Well, yeah, I may go against the tide here, but I, for one, would be perfectly willing to spend some money every year out of my wallet to get dredging done.
Well, you sure, they could tack a couple of extra dollars on the registration fees or a lot of other options, and, you know, most folks are probably against that at this point. But if we look at the bigger picture, and that money didn't go into a general fund and rather went specifically to a waterway fund, it would make a big difference, I think.
I'm on a rant now, but, I mean, maybe the Intercoastal Waterway Association could set up a fund that people could donate to.
Well, that's maybe a suggestion we should make to them.
Yeah. It just... Your Little Mud River, the last time Janice and I went through there, Janice is saying, go to starboard. I got the wheel over, and we're going straight ahead. We were dragging the keel through the mud.
Yeah, we call it farming the bottom.
Yep. So, but, you know, we've experienced that there's at the North Edisto River in South Carolina, there's a spot that's been there for all the time I know. Towboat US can make a fortune just sticking a boat out there most weekends.
Exactly. And actually, they just dredged that out, and within a year, it had shoaled back in again, and it'll probably be a long time before it's dredged again.
Yeah. And it just, you know, I mean, we live fairly close to that, and we don't, if we need to go through there, we actually determine our departure time on when high tide is going to be there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So let's talk about seamanship and courtesy a little bit.
Okay, that has always really been an issue for me, especially the last few years. And as I said, our first trip down the waterway, we spent days and days and days, and we were the only boat on the waterway. And anybody that's done the trip in the last couple of years knows that that's just no longer the case. And as I said, the number of boats that are doing the migration has exploded. And it just seems to me that there are either a lot of boaters out there that have bought a boat recently and decided, wow, I'm going to take off down the waterway, and they just don't have a lot of experience, or maybe it's a reflection of our society, I'm not sure which, but there just seems to be a lot of a total lack, not a total, but a large part, a lack of good seamanship skills, and even in some cases, total consideration for some of the other boaters out there. Because if you've made the trip lately and you've got your VHF radio on, I mean, we've seen so many times where the radio is just full of one boat chastising another and somebody calling somebody else nasty names, and at times it gets pretty heated out there. And a lot of it is just, I think, if folks would just slow down, follow the rules of the road, be a little more courteous, it wouldn't be an issue. And of course, boats passing boats is probably the biggest example of what I'm talking about. And I think it probably falls upon both the boaters doing the passing and the boaters being passed. Some boats try to slow down for other boats and call them on the radio and ask them if they would slow down so they can give them a slow pass, and they get no response, so they just keep plugging away at whatever speed, and by the time they catch up to the other boat, they send them rocking and rolling seriously. And then there are other boats that seem to get a certain amount of joy out of waking another boat that goes by. And, you know, what they don't consider, and we've seen it happening to us on several occasions, that those wakes have been serious enough that had we not prepared ourselves and the boat for it and virtually hung on for dear life, somebody could have gotten seriously injured, and there's always the potential for things on the boat to get damaged. So it seems to have become more and more of a problem here in the last, I think, maybe 4 or 5 years.
Well, Janice and I had an experience maybe 2 years ago where there was a group of boats like we were talking about before, and they managed to figure out how to wake us, all 7 or 8 of them, 3 different times in the same day. So at the end of the day, I was like, I want a cannon.
Oh, I can't tell you how many times people have thought about that. And, you know, they make these things that they call water cannons, which is essentially a slingshot that you hook up on the boat somewhere and put water balloons in them. And I've thought more than once about arming yourself with one of those.
Where the heck were we one time? There was a boatyard there, and apparently he used a slingshot to shoot rotten eggs at the boats that were waking his boatyard.
It is a problem for the shoreline and boats tied to docks and marinas and a lot of different things.
True. Yeah, we just get waked. I mean, until the sun goes down and it gets dark and all the boats go home, it's all day long. Yeah. You know?
Go ahead, Roger. And one of the things that I keep finding is the motorboat guys just don't care about the sailors. They'll blow past me so fast that it rocks me all over the place.
Yeah, and being a power boater now, we have to keep reminding ourselves that, you know, we have to change that perception.
The perception that loopers have is the two guys you're going to get waked by are sport fishermen and sea rays.
And yeah, well, I think sport fishermen idle at 3,000 RPMs, which is the problem with those boats.
Well, I've seen them go into the dock going backwards at 3,000 RPMs. So. and it's not true of all of them, but that's where you're going to get a lot of your problems from. A trawler passing a sailboat is not much of a contest. I mean, the trawler's maybe a knot faster than the sailboat in most cases.
Exactly.
When I can see a sailboat mast, when I leave in the morning, it'll take me all day to catch the guy.
Do you think maybe it's time for licensing of people who are going to drive a boat, like you have a driver's license for a car, and maybe that money and paying for the dredging of the intercoastal and other things?
I have mixed emotions about that for a long time, but as time goes on, I'm more and more a believer that it would be extremely helpful, provided it was done correctly. If you essentially had to get a driver's license like you do a car and demonstrate that you have the skills rather than just go online and take an online
right.
course, that really
right.
doesn't do much for you. So, yeah, I believe that would be helpful, and I agree with you. We could take those dollars and put it towards waterway funds that would be useful. But, you know, once again, I don't know that the states have the will to do that, although a couple of them have kind of leaned in that direction.
It seems like with more and more boaters out there, it's really time to do something. It's, I think people need to show that they know how to handle a boat before they're allowed to do it.
No, I agree.
Yeah, it seems kind of silly. You go out and spend $2 million on a boat, jump on it, never driven a boat before, and you can just drive it away. No problem.
Yeah.
Sure, I used to be a broker, and I sold boats, and we'd sell a 40- or 50-foot power boat, and I'd say, okay, well, what kind of boats did you own before? Well, I had a 19-foot center console.
Right.
And when they pull away from the dock, my heart's pounding in my chest.
Yeah, I had a rowboat one time.
Yeah, exactly.
That
issue has come up a couple times within HLCA, and you would be surprised at how many people are adamant about they don't want the government intruding in their lives at the extent that they have to have a license to run their boat.
Sure, but they don't mind in a heartbeat renewing their driver's license out on the highway, and there's not a lot of difference at this point.
Yeah, you know, maybe they object to that too, but they can't get away with it because it's mandatory.
Right.
Anyway, we're getting off on rants again here, so...
Well, these are important issues we should talk about.
I can rant about
right.
the waking thing all day. I live on my boat, and I can tell when it's the weather's getting nice, and the people are coming in and out of the docks. I can tell when it's that time of year.
Yep.
When it rolls me out of bed in the morning, you know.
Well, it's good something does, right?
Yeah.
Easy.
Why don't we move on to changes in the towns and anchorages, Chuck? What have you seen?
Actually, considerable changes. And as I had mentioned earlier, you know, we were talking about the development along the waterway. And what a lot of that development has done is to displace a lot of the facilities in the marinas that the boaters have used in the past and really need. What used to be a marina is now a 10-story high-rise condominium, and the property for the marinas has gotten so valuable that they'll sell out to the developers because they're not making any money as a marina anymore. So that's a major change. And because I don't know if it's because of the economy or just the sheer number of boats increasing, but we've seen a lot of the local anchorages. Georgetown is an excellent example of that. It was one of our favorite stops along the waterway, but there's virtually no place for you to come in and anchor anymore because there are so many local boats that are anchored and unattended in the harbor that you just virtually isn't any room. And then what happens is as soon as some bad weather comes up, even if you found a place to anchor, you've got all these unattended boats dragging anchor all over the place, and it becomes a safety issue. So that has become a serious problem in some of our even favorite spots. And then because of that same issue, a lot of the towns have gone from allowing open anchorages to installing mooring fields. And, of course, we all know that that's a big issue, especially down in Florida now, about a lot of the anchorages being converted to moorings. But Charleston's a good example. We used to anchor there every year coming up and down the waterway across from the city marina there, and now those are all moorings. So many areas in Florida are now going to moorings, Marathon, Vero Beach. Those are places where there are no longer or very little places to anchor. There are proposed mooring fields now going into Sarasota and a couple of other areas.
What's the big objection to using a mooring field?
Well, I really don't have any objection to using it. And in some cases, it's actually a big improvement because it gives you shore access that you didn't have before and maybe access to facilities in one of the marinas, whoever is handling the mooring field and that type of thing. And in a lot of cases, it's probably more secure than dropping your anchor. You don't have to worry about the mooring dragging when
a ball comes
through and that type of thing. And I guess the objection is that it is giving us less and less opportunities in some of our favorite areas just to be able to come in and drop the anchor for free and enjoy the area And even if we wanted to come in the afternoon and anchor for the night and pick up and take off the next morning, there's some places that we can't do that now, where we virtually have to pay if we just want to set overnight till the sun comes up, so when we can leave again. But there are pluses and minuses, I think, for both of those.
Chuck, there was a lot of discussion in our discussion forum this week about that issue with moorings. I think we probably could do a show alone and just have people express their different opinions, but it's a hot issue right now.
Absolutely, and I would be willing to bet that you give a little advance notice, you'd have a lot of call-ins on that one. But those are the biggest changes that we've seen along the way. And don't get me wrong, there are still lots and lots and lots of great anchorages out there that you can just come in and anchor and spend a peaceful evening, a day or two, or hide from bad weather. And many, many of the towns along the waterway haven't changed hardly at all in the last 10 years or so that we've been doing, or 20 years that we've been doing this. So there's still plenty out there to enjoy that have not changed.
Well, one of the places that always comes to mind with me is that section between Georgetown and Myrtle Beach, where you have all the cypress swamps, and there are just,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like every 100 yards is a great anchorage in that area.
Oh, yeah. And if you can play the tides in Georgia, people tell me that they hate going through Georgia because you just wind back and forth. We often say when we go through Georgia, we pass ourselves several times.
Yeah, oh yeah.
but if you can get the tides right and avoid the really problematic places, it's some of the most spectacular anchorages we've been in.
Well, it always runs through my mind when we're going south from Charleston is, that part of South Carolina and Georgia, it must look like it did when the first settlers came over 500 years ago.
The Waccamaw River is without a doubt we could cruise up and down that river and just stop in little places and anchor for a month if we had the time.
Yeah, and the Waccamaw River is one of the most spectacular sections of the Great Loop, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely.
But it just looks like it has to have looked like that when the first people came over from Europe,
Yes. Actually, we thought that's probably the way it looked when the dinosaurs were kicking the trees.
Yeah. And the same thing with the southern part of South Carolina and Georgia. They have those same vistas when you're going through McClellanville, when you're in the National Wildlife Refuge, and there's nothing there for miles and miles and miles.
Absolutely.
What are some of your favorite stops?
Oh, gosh, there are so many of them. Let's see, what comes to mind? Elizabeth City is one. Georgetown is another. Bellhaven, we love Charleston.
Where do you go in Bellhaven?
Pardon?
Where do you stop in Bellhaven?
Actually, usually when we're in Bellhaven, we anchor right there in the basin probably half of the time. The other half of the time, we usually go to River Forest.
Okay. Well, it's funny because Janice and I, is just up from River Forest, there's a Bellhaven Waterway Marina, which is a little mom and pop. They probably don't have room for but about three boats. And we love
right,
it.
Right.
The people are wonderful. It's right in the middle of downtown Bellhaven, for whatever that's worth. But that's the place that we go rather than the forest.
Right. Well, we've tried to get in there a couple of times, and they didn't have space for us. They were full.
Yeah.
So that says something for them.
Yep. So anyway, that's one of the stops we like is Bald Head Island.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And Beaufort, South Carolina is another one that is one of our favorite stops.
Yep.
Actually, we stopped there once and stayed for a year. that's a true story.
So where
well,
do we
go? Thank you so much for your input, Chuck.
Well, you're quite welcome.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell us before we close?
Well, Absolutely. I mean, one thing I really wanted to mention is that we've watched so many people rushing up and down the waterway. You know, they leave the Chesapeake and say, oh, I need to get to Florida, or oh, I need to get to Bahamas. So it's, you know, every day, fire up the engines, get underway, go as far as you can, stop, and then repeat it. And there are so much to see and so much to enjoy along that way that the trip itself should be part of the destination, if you will. We always used to say, you know, stop and smell the fish fry along the way. And you just need to slow down and enjoy it.
Our experience with the waterway is if you want to gain weight, go to restaurants. Because every place you go, they have some fabulous restaurants. And even in little small towns, there's great places to eat.
Yeah, I agree.
You want to talk about side trips some, Jen?
I think Chuck has basically said this town he likes. Did you want to go into side trips? Any recommendations, Chuck?
If we have a couple of minutes here. And then we were talking about Elizabeth City, and one of the kind of side trips that a lot of people avoid is the Dismal Swamp route, rather than going through Virginia Cut from Norfolk. And, I mean, that Dismal Swamp is just beautiful. But then the stops in Elizabeth City, and we really enjoy getting to some of those out-of-the-way places off the beaten path that a lot of cruisers miss. And these are areas, Albemarle Sound is a good example, small towns of Edenton, and getting out to the Outer Banks and Hatteras and Roanoke Sound, Manteo. Those are spectacular little towns, and they probably haven't changed much for the last 100 years. A lot of little towns in the Pamlico Sound in North Carolina, Washington and Bath and New Bern. And, you know, everybody rushes south to get past those, and those are, to us, those are don't-miss places and side trips that make the whole trip worthwhile. The St. John's River, you know, if you didn't want to get down into the Fort Lauderdale and Florida Keys madhouse, you can go out into the St. John River and spend a whole winter cruising that river and see very few other cruising boats, but there's so many places to enjoy. And St. Mary's River, getting into that Fernandina, St. Mary's, Cumberland Island, we like to call that triangle. You can spend weeks or a month there just hanging around having a great time. So they're a little bit out of the way, but not a lot out of the way, and really trips that, in our opinion, are don't miss.
Chuck, if you had nothing to do and nothing to get home for, how long would you recommend taking to travel basically from Virginia to Florida?
We have taken as long as 5 months on a leisure trip.
Uh-huh. That's great. Well, hopefully we'll get to this point one day where, actually, Steve and I have gone out for almost 3 months and we're able to run the organization. So hopefully we'll get there soon.
One of the side trips that Janice and I have done is up the Potomac and into Washington, and we ended
absolutely.
We had a ball, and they have the marinas that are right down in the middle of the heart of Washington, and you can get to anything you want to get to fairly easily.
Right, and a lot of these smaller towns, especially in North Carolina and so forth, when you go into the towns, Elizabeth City is a good example. They have town docks which are totally free, and you're right there tied up at the waterfront downtown. And a lot of these towns have done a wonderful job in restoring their downtown waterfront.
And there's some other ones that are working on it. Swansboro is apparently going to put in a very big municipal marina that covers most of the waterfront.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Georgetown's another excellent example. The first time we went through there, the waterfront was mostly closed down buildings and really in rough shape. And they have just done a wonderful job in rehabilitating that downtown waterfront area.
Well, yeah, Georgetown is – we had gone in there one time in Harbor Walk Marina, and it was a dive. I mean, it was awful.
Yeah, exactly.
And they've since put in all floating docks and done a great job, and now it's the place we, anytime we go to Georgetown, we stay there.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think we're about finished.
Well, that's good.
Well, thank
we didn't
you
go too much over. Well, you're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. For our listeners out there, next week we will be having Joe and Mary Beth Amelia. They're a couple that travel together, and they're on a sailboat with a gas engine, and I'm not sure what to expect on their experiences, but I'm sure it'll be very interesting to listen. I guess that's it for now. Steve, did you want to close?
Well, you know, anybody that's listening, we'd love to have you as a member. If you go to www.greatloop.org, you can join up. And the other thing is all of these shows are archived and open to the public and are on that website under radio.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, thanks, everybody. Talk
bye-bye.
To you next week.
Bye-bye.
Have
all
a
right,
good
you
guys.
Day.
Have a great season.
You too.
Your sunblock.
Thank you. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye.